MechCast, Tuesday, August 13th, 2019. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to another episode of the MechCast. Glad to be back here with you for another week of Apple Mac news, information, and your feedback, questions, all that other fun stuff. I hope you're having a great week. Things have been going well here at MechCast HQ, just working along, following along with what's happening with Apple. And we've got a few things going on this week. It was kind of a bad week for batteries. We're going to talk about that a little bit. Also, HomePod, how's it doing in the marketplace? Yeah, you might imagine how it's doing. Apple has launched a new bounty program. We'll talk about that. And are you ready for some more Pro models of Apple devices? Yep, we got some of that in the news. And then also a little expansion of Apple Maps. Some of you are going to be very excited if you're looking for map improvements in your region. Others of you are probably still waiting on some improvements to come. But Apple has a plan for you as well, especially if you're in the States, but also even outside the States. So we're going to get into all that in the news. We're going to talk about something that's going on again with my 15-inch MacBook Pro related to its battery stuff. I'll give you some of my thoughts and opinions on that. And then we're going to dig in deep on Apple Card. Yep, it is here, and there's a lot of information. So we're going to give you some tips and tricks on that. If you've got your Apple Card yet, maybe if you are have yet to get your invite and want an Apple Card, and maybe even some information if you're not interested in an Apple Card whatsoever, might give you some excuses for not getting one. And then we've got a question about personal cloud backup and storage, and that's going to round out this episode of the MacCast. So should be a good one. I say we just dive right in and talk about the news this week. Yep, it has been a bad week for batteries, a couple different fronts. Here at the top of the show, we'll talk about what iFixit discovered when they tried to replace a battery in a recent iPhone. According to iFixit, they say that Apple appears to have activated a dormant software lock in iOS for batteries on the iPhone XS, iPhone XS Max, and iPhone XR. Basically, what's happening is if anyone other than Apple or an Apple authorized service provider replaces a battery in one of those models of iPhones, even with an official Apple one. So they did some testing. Actually, I think iFixit did some testing based on something that was revealed by another YouTuber. But basically, they confirmed that if you put in a third-party battery, if you replace the battery even with one from another iPhone, so an official Apple battery, the Settings app will display a service message. And when you tap on that service message, it says, important battery message, unable to verify this iPhone has a genuine Apple battery. And again, this happens even if you swap in a quote-unquote genuine Apple battery. Not only that, once you've done this, it means you also will not have access to iOS's battery health feature, so you won't even know with a new battery, how is it wearing? What is its charge cycles? All those sorts of things without plugging into maybe a Mac or something, some other device, and using a third-party tool to look at the battery cycles. You just won't have access to the built-in iOS stuff. And why is this happening? The issue appears to be Texas Instruments microcontroller that is on the battery itself. So this is something that's pretty common in batteries. The microcontroller then allows features. In this case, that feature is an authentication feature, which basically pairs the battery to the iPhone's logic board at the factory. And the batteries that Apple is making actually have a custom version of this chip. So there's kind of the universal one, and then there's also this custom version that Apple has put together. So only Apple really knows the secret sauce for how to pair a replacement battery with your iPhone. So if there's not a match, that means you don't get access to the battery settings. You get the service message. And again, this is only on the latest iPhones, the XS, XS Max, and the iPhone XR. If you have a different model, you're not going to be impacted by this. Now, this sounds bad up front, right? Apple has taken a lot of flack for not being open in their repairs. iFixit is always critical of them. They're vying for having a right to repair bill in a lot of states. Apple's reasoning behind this likely is having to do with safety and quality of batteries. But this definitely does limit your options, at least in a way. As far as they can tell, putting in a third-party battery, there's no other crippling, like Apple doesn't do anything like throttling your iPhone if you have a third-party battery, anything like that. The only thing that gets locked out is the battery health feature. So you lose some functionality, but you could still get a third-party replacement battery and have it serviced yourself or by a non-Apple authorized service provider or not by Apple. But again, you're going to lose this functionality. The only way to retain this functionality is you would have to pay Apple or an Apple authorized service provider to do the battery swap, because they have access to whatever tools they need to kind of do this pairing. So can be a little bit frustrating, something to definitely be aware of if you have one of these devices and you need to get a battery replacement. And it'll be interesting to see how Apple reacts to this story, if maybe they open these tools up, because, you know, I think the ability, especially on an older device, as these get older and older, to just swap out a battery yourself if you want to do that, if you feel like you're technically inclined and capable of doing it. You know, my personal opinion is I feel people should be able to do that. I don't think you should have to be forced to go to a particular provider. Now, I personally recommend that you go to Apple or an Apple authorized service provider, because I think, again, you're going to get the best quality product. You're going to get the best quality service and repair. Those people know what they're doing. You know, if you're just going to the guy at the kiosk in the mall, I don't know. I'm always a little bit leery of that. I'm sure there's some very talented people there, very capable people. I've swapped components and parts in my older iPhones on my own, and there's always a satisfaction from doing that. But, you know, this is the state of affairs right now. So what's your thought on this? Is this a really bad thing? Is Apple just trying to protect the consumer? Batteries can be dangerous if they're not the right product, if they're installed improperly. There can be some problems. So Apple may be just looking to control that. And they've taken some heat and flack for laptop batteries and iPhone batteries, you know, having fires and explosions and things like that. So, I don't know where the line falls. It's kind of a tricky one, but I think I fall more on the side of iFixit, where the consumer should be the one to be able to choose, and Apple sort of locking out features is not super cool. So that's just my thought on it. Share your thoughts and opinions. Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. Let's talk a little bit about HomePod and its place in the smart speaker market. Consumer Intelligence Research Partners released its report on smart speakers for the second quarter of 2019, and Apple's HomePod only represented about 5% of the estimated 76 million units that are currently installed in the U.S. market. Now, that's not too shabby if you do the math, about 3.8 million units in the U.S., and if you realize that Apple sells those HomePods for $299, originally for $349 U.S., that's about $1.13 billion worth of HomePods out there in the market. So, you know, I think Apple's probably okay with their 5%, but still, Apple's share was dwarfed by Amazon and Google, which have 70% and 25% of the U.S. market, respectively. The thing is, about 50% of the total market is in the cheaper devices. The Echo Dot, which I can hardly argue is a speaker. I actually have an Amazon Echo Dot. It's a great product, don't get me wrong, but it's really more of a, you know, smart assistant device than it is a quote-unquote speaker. Like, I really wouldn't want to listen to music on it. Of course, you can attach it to an external speaker and get better sound quality, but, you know, there you go. The Google Home Mini was also part of that, of course, both $50 products. So it does seem to indicate that in the smart speaker market, consumers are responding to lower cost devices. So that does bring up the question, should Apple try to get into that lower end of the market? My personal opinion is I don't think they should go to the very low end of the market, the $50, sub-$50 speaker. But if they could get a good sounding mid-level product at a, say, $99 to $149 price point, I think that sort of device could do very well. And we've heard rumors in the past that Apple has looked into that, that they've considered it. I'd love to expand out my current HomePod with a couple of satellite speakers. And if I could get a little lower end ones just to fill out a couple rooms in my house, I definitely would probably plunk down $100, $150 for a couple more units. So I think that that would be a good move for Apple to make. Are they going to do it? Right now, we're not really hearing rumors to that effect. Those rumors kind of were floating around when HomePod was first launched. We haven't heard really anything about it since. But again, it's an interesting thing to think about. And in case you're worrying about, you know, the number of HomePods that Apple are selling and how it might affect their bottom line, especially in their other category. So HomePod falls into the other category with accessories and AirPods and Apple Watches, all those sorts of things. You don't need to worry about that, because where HomePod might be lagging, it's possible that AirPods and Apple Watches could more than make up for it. If you remember last episode of the MacCast, we talked about that nice slice of the pie that is coming out of Apple's other category. Well, analyst Neil Seibert thinks that those two products, the AirPods and the Apple Watches, could actually at some point overtake iPad and Mac in terms of making up Apple's sales. He says it could even happen by the end of next year. Apple's wearables business is at $16 billion annually. That's its current run rate, and Seibert thinks that its growth rate of about 50 to 60% is going to continue through the next year. And if that does happen by the end of 2020, that other category could definitely overtake iPad and Mac. So you would have basically iPhone, then services, then wearables, what amounts to wearables, because general consensus is that AirPods and Apple Watches probably make up the largest percentage in terms of revenue of that other category. Of course, you have other things like Beats headphones in there, you have HomePod, you have cables, accessories, all those other bits and pieces, but the major chunk, they think AirPods and Apple Watches are kind of accounting for that. So that could be Apple's third largest source of revenue, and it could even overtake services. It's kind of right up there. It's definitely on a larger growth rate. The question would be, can Apple sustain that? And they might, because again, they're going to be adding other things into that other category. A lot of the stuff we're hearing about, AR products, VR products, if Apple does end up doing glasses or something like that, that would definitely fall into that wearables category. So that is a potential area of growth as iPhone is sort of shrinking. That and services might be where Apple is really targeting its future growth, at least in the short term, potentially the long term, although I think things like the autonomous vehicle project and those sorts of stuff are going to expand upon that. And of course, that would be a whole different category of product that Apple would be moving into. But for now, good growth in that other category. The Black Hat Conference was happening this past week, and Apple was there. They've been there in the past, but they were there this time around, and one of the big announcements that they had coming out of Black Hat was that they upped and expanded their bug bounty program, and it now finally includes Mac OS. So a while back in 2016, they announced a program for iOS. Now they have expanded that, so White Hat hackers and researchers can now actually get some serious cash for finding exploits in macOS, tvOS, watchOS, iOS, and iCloud. So they are letting them go after all of the different OSs and iCloud itself, and if they can find exploits, they can get some pretty serious cash for it, some pretty good revenue. So they had originally, I think, had amounts up to $200,000. You can now get up to $1 million for various bounties. So the bug bounty program is being increased in terms of the payouts that Apple is willing to give. It's being increased in terms of which operating systems and which services they're going to pay out for. And also, they're opening it up. It had been sort of restricted before. Now they are going to open it up to all security researchers, and that will happen later this year. Again, the max payout was increased from $200,000 to $1 million. To get that $1 million bounty, you're going to need to find a zero-click kernel code execution exploit with persistence. So it's not, you know, no small feat, but if any researcher finds a vulnerability and it happens to be in a pre-release software, so something before it hits the market, they can be eligible for up to a 50% bonus on that payout. So you can get even more money. And for researchers that have a, quote, track record of high-quality systems security research, Apple said they're also going to be offering up access to dev devices like iPhones, dev versions basically of iPhones, and this is something they've never done before. These would be devices that would be more open. They would have features like SSH, root shell access, and advanced debugging capabilities, so the researchers can really get in there and try and find exploits. And really what this is all about is hardening and securing Apple's products and operating systems. And so this is a good move. This is a good positive move in that direction. It's going to benefit all of us and will really help even more solidify how secure the Mac operating system is. Of course, no operating system, no devices are 100% secure, but these are the kinds of programs that are going to help do that. And Apple really, let's be honest, had been lagging behind in this, behind a lot of other companies like Google and Microsoft in terms of offering up bug bounties and incentivizing researchers to actually report bugs and give Apple information. So this should help a lot in that arena. And we're all going to ultimately benefit from it. One other thing that happened at Black Hat, some researchers also showed off a way that they could get past Face ID's liveness detection. You probably know that Face ID requires attention. It also kind of has a feature in it where someone can't just go up to you when you're sleeping or unconscious or potentially dead and just wave the phone in front of your face and have it unlock. It actually needs to be able to see your eyes. It needs to detect that you're a living person. Well, researchers found a way around this. Basically, they had a set of glasses with tape on them that had white squares with smaller black squares in the middle, and they could place this over the face of someone who was sleeping or unconscious and then get the iPhone to unlock using Face ID. Kind of a cool parlor trick, but as you might imagine, not really practical. Hardly an exploit that I think anybody needs to have cause for alarm. But again, the good thing about stuff like this is they were showing it off at Black Hat, and they offered up some suggestions and recommendations how the system could be improved so that this exploit wouldn't work. So this is all about making these systems better. I don't think we're going to see people running around with weird glasses trying to force sleeping people to get their iPhones unlocked. I think just getting a set of glasses on someone who was sleeping might be a bit difficult. Maybe if they were unconscious, if you had some really nefarious people, that could be going on. But again, I don't think this is a huge deal, but just something interesting that, again, came out of the Black Hat conference that was Apple-related this week. Are you ready for an iPhone Pro? If you are, then you might be interested in the tweet from Twitter user CoinX. And you might be going, who is CoinX and why are we talking about a rumor that he might have posted out there? He or she, actually. I don't even know if it's male or female. But this person does have a track record of getting some recent product leaks and information right. So especially around naming of potential future Apple products, and the tweet basically said that at least one of this year's iPhone models is going to get Pro branding, so will be called the iPhone Pro. It's not clear if it would just be more of a rebranding of the iPhone XS Max model. I would imagine it would be sort of the largest device that Apple makes, although leading up to this, we've heard that like things like the triple camera lens system and a lot of the other new features were going to be on both the update to the iPhone XS and XS Max. We've been just simply calling these models the iPhone 11s, so it's sounding like there could be an iPhone 11 Pro. And I'm okay with that naming. It seems to line up. I actually thought Apple would switch to it before this because it lines up perfectly with what they're doing with iPad, with what they're doing with Macs. You know, you have the MacBook Air and you have the MacBook Pro. You have the iMac and you have the iMac Pro. You have the iPad and you have the iPad Pro. So I think it only makes sense that we have the iPhone and the iPhone Pro. The question I have in my mind is, does that mean the iPhone XR update becomes just simply the iPhone, and maybe the iPhone XS and XS Max become the iPhone Pro models? I guess you'd still have the, you know, is it iPhone Pro, iPhone Pro Max? I think that's a little weird. I don't think they're going to do that. So it'll be interesting. It's always fun to think about naming and what Apple might name potential new products. I'm also curious if they will call it the iPhone 11. So will it be iPhone 11 Pro, iPhone 11 Pro Max? I don't know. I really don't. Even as I say it, it sounds kind of bad. But I think this could be the year of the iPhone Pro. The other rumor that happened this week related to Pro devices, this time the iPad Pros, came out of Mac Attacara. They say that the updated iPad Pros, expected probably to be announced this October, could adopt the same multi-lens camera systems that we're expecting to see in the iPhone. So that would mean that the iPhone or the iPad Pros would get the triple lens camera system, and the updated iPad, which is expected to be a new 10.2-inch model, would get a dual lens camera system, just like is expected in the updated iPhone XR. Something interesting about cameras and iPads, Apple hasn't, you know, as you know, really been updating them or keeping them as up to date as they have the iPhones. And this would definitely be a departure from that. I personally don't use the camera on my iPad Pro at all. I'm trying to think if I ever take pictures with it. So it's never been a kind of key feature for me. But I do know that I've seen other people, and I've seen people in the wild who do use iPads as cameras. So, you know, maybe this would be a big selling point for upgraders, and it would help Apple sort of juice the iPad market. What are your thoughts? Do you care about cameras in your iPad, and would having a triple lens on a future iPad Pro make a difference to you? Shoot me some email, maccast@gmail.com. Give me some feedback. And then finally, another new accessory, or I shouldn't say new accessory, another accessory that got updated this week is Apple's USB-C digital to AV multi-port adapter. And while that might not sound like big news, it actually is kind of big news because it now supports HDMI 2.0, which means that you can get a 60 hertz refresh rate at resolutions of 3840 by 2160, and also it brings and adds HDR10 and Dolby Vision HDR support to that adapter. So you can take that adapter, connect it to your iPad Pro, to your latest Macs, and get some really nice quality HDMI video out of it on some pretty massive displays. And best of all, it still sells for the same price point, $69 US, and it is available now at Apple stores and Apple Store app and Apple Online. So you can grab that and get better video out of your devices. And then finally, in the news for this week, a couple states are getting better versions of Apple Maps. Apple, you know, has been working hard on updating their Apple mapping system with their own first-party data. We've got all the Apple cars driving around. We know we're going to get the new Street View-like feature with iOS 13, and I'm really looking forward to that. Look around, I believe, is what Apple calls that. And they had been slowly working their way down California, When I looked at the map, I thought they had made it about to Bakersfield or the Central Valley, but in the report I was reading, they said that they actually did all of Southern California and Hawaii in November of 2018, and that they had expanded the updated maps to Arizona, New Mexico, and metropolitan Las Vegas in earlier in 2019, so all of those locations already have the updated mapping data, and now it looks like they've expanded into Eastern Texas, Louisiana, and Southern Mississippi. And basically what you get is you get a lot more detail in the Apple Maps. They have a lot more of the 3D buildings. You have a lot more detail like parks and grass and trees and sports fields and information on parking lots and just a whole lot more information. And it's actually really great. When you go into one of the regions that has the updated data, it is really, really helpful. And it just looks beautiful too. And what's really cool is you can really see where Apple has updated the data. If you go in to the Apple Maps app and just zoom out and look at kind of a higher level view of California, of the United States, you can see where California, Eastern Texas, Louisiana, Southern Mississippi, parts of Arizona, New Mexico, that whole area, they'll have a lot more green colors and textures, and you can see how yellow and barren the rest of the country looks. And so that's how you can tell what sort of areas they've updated the mapping data in. And don't despair if you're in other parts of the United States, because at Worldwide Developer Conference, if you may remember, Apple stated that they plan to roll out the updated mapping data to the entire United States by the end of the year. Seems like they're a little behind on that, right? They're going to have to roll out a lot more quickly because we're slowly running out of time. We're getting to the end of summer, but Apple says they're going to get there, at least in the United States, and then they also plan to roll out expanded mapping data to other countries. They haven't specified which ones, but into other countries in 2020. So Apple will start rolling out that data to outside the U.S. sometime next year. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, and that is Masterclass. Oh my gosh, you guys, I am in love with Masterclass. I've been using it for over a year. I just re-upped for another year, and I think it is amazing. One of the best things about Masterclass, and one of my favorite things, is the amazing depth and variety of the kinds of courses that they have on there, and they're all taught by masters in their fields. It's like unbelievable when you go into the app and you see the kind of talent you get in these courses. You can't find this anyplace else. And one of the things that's been exciting about Masterclass for my family is my daughter is an aspiring writer, and she's been able to take advantage of Masterclass to learn how to create memorable characters from Judy Blum, to learn world building from Neil Gaiman. I mean, Neil Gaiman, come on. And I was able to tune into the Gaiman lessons, and he did one using one of my favorite books, The Graveyard Book, as a case study in how character motivations help build compelling plots. And it was really, really cool to listen to him talk about that. And I also love with Masterclass just the quality of the lessons. They have this cinematic quality to the presentations of the courses, and they make each one unique. They all kind of fit together, but each teacher and each lesson kind of has its own style, or each course has its own style, and they're incredibly well produced. And best of all, they're kind of in small chunks, so typically 10 to 15 minutes, and that means I can easily fit them into my schedule. And that's made even easier by the fact that you have Masterclass on all your devices, all your platforms. So they have iPhone, iPad apps, you can get it on the Mac through the web, and best of all, you can get it on the Apple TV now, so you can watch right there in your living room. And while you can get courses individually, I really love having the all-access pass, because here's what inevitably happened to me. Like, I'm watching these courses on writing and learning how to be a better storyteller and all those things. And what's great about that is that translates into things like my podcasting. So I don't want to be a writer, but I'm learning all kinds of things that I can use as a podcaster about storytelling and how to present material and just be better at that. And so that's great. I'm learning all that. But then you get in there and I start running across other things, right? If you're like me, I see this Aaron Franklin course on how to make smoked pork ribs. And I love ribs. It's like my favorite food. And I am not kidding. I watched this and I learned how to trim up ribs, prepare the ribs, and learned why that's actually so important in the cooking process. And I've never done that before. I just throw the ribs on the grill, and I'm going to have better ribs and better cooking because of Masterclass. And other things, like I've always been fascinated and wanted to learn magic, and I've tried other videos and tried lessons online and stuff like that, but it's never really clicked. And then they have a Penn and Teller video on how to do magic. And again, they're teaching a lot of presentation stuff that I can use in other areas of my life. But within the course, they went through the concepts and teaching the lessons to a group, and then got into really detailed videos showing you the up close moves and stuff like that. So it made it really easy to learn. It was kind of broken down into all these parts. And they also have supplemental downloads like PDFs where I can get photos and instructions and all that stuff. So they have like over 60 classes right now, and they're constantly adding more. And so I just think it's a great investment in learning. And so if you haven't looked into Masterclass, you definitely should go take a look. And best of all, you can have unlimited access to every Masterclass as a MacCast listener and get $30 off. Just go to masterclass.com/MacCast for $30 off your Masterclass All Access Pass. And be sure you act now because this is actually a limited time offer. So masterclass.com/MacCast. And I know you're going to love it and get a lot of benefit from the courses there. So big thank you to Masterclass for their support of the show. I already told you it was a bad week for Apple and batteries. So we had the story earlier about the battery lockout in the iPhone. Now I want to tell you about my poor MacBook Pro. You may remember I have a 15-inch 2015 MacBook Pro, and it suffered the battery recall from Apple. Actually, it wasn't too bad. It went really well. If you remember my story about it, basically all I had to do was take it into Apple, although it did take a week to get the battery replaced. So I was without my machine for a week. That was probably the worst part. But Apple simply replaced it. It didn't cost me anything. They're taking care of it. It was a voluntary recall. No one's making them do it. But they had just discovered that some models had bad batteries, and rather than risk it, they went ahead and replaced them. The thing is that the FAA got word about that and has decided that a 2015 15-inch MacBook Pro, because of its battery recall, is now on the banned list of devices for taking on a plane. Now, it still remains to be seen what the airlines are going to actually do, but the FAA has told them that they need to adhere to the agency's 2016 safety instructions for devices with recalled batteries, which basically means you can't take it on board as a carry-on, and you cannot put it into your checked luggage. It's basically your 2015 recalled MacBook Pro, 15-inch MacBook Pro, cannot be allowed on planes. Now, will they start banning it? How will they even check? Like, I don't know, because it says that if you've had a replaced battery, like mine does, that you're perfectly fine. You're all clear. You can go on the plane just fine. But they can't look in there to see if you have a, like, fixed battery or if you still have the recalled battery. So I don't even know how you enforce this sort of thing other than relying on the honesty of people. So I guess I'll tell you, if you have a recalled 2015-inch MacBook Pro and you haven't had the battery replaced by Apple yet, hey, you're not supposed to take it on a plane, at least here in the U.S. Also in the U.K. and Canada, some airlines, I think mostly ones that haul cargo as well as passengers, have also banned the 2015 15-inch MacBook Pro from their planes. So that 2015 15-inch MacBook Pro getting a little bit of a bad rap because of its battery. And I just thought that was interesting because it just came up, you know, with my machine. This is honestly something I thought I would never be covering on a show about Apple and Macintosh, and that is tips and tricks surrounding a credit card. Yes, the Apple card. Why would we ever be talking about a credit card? But, you know, hey, it is kind of exciting. It's been happening this week. The early invites went out. Many of you have received your Apple cards. I actually, last time we spoke, I had not received my early invite. I was actually a little bit bitter about it. But I did now receive my invite, and I signed up. I have my digital Apple card. I don't have my physical Apple card yet. I don't have the cool titanium one in my wallet, but I did get to sign up. And I got a lot of feedback from many of you who were able to sign up for your cards, and even some feedback and pictures from some of you who have your physical cards. And everybody is very happy to receive their Apple card. Now, I know I'm talking to a lot of you in the community. There's a lot of you who are a little bit frustrated that Apple's doing this. You're not super excited by Apple Card, and that's fine. I totally get that too. It is, at the end of the day, just a freaking credit card, right? But it is one from Apple, and it's a little bit of a different business than they've been in. And I know they're partnering with Goldman Sachs, so they're not even really in the credit card business. They're doing the software side of things, which is actually pretty exciting. I think they are trying to change things. Are they totally disrupting the industry? Probably not. There's not a lot of huge things here. We already talked about the fact that I don't agree with their saying that they're, you know, offering these great low interest rates. I think they're pretty standard. We'll talk about that a little bit here. So we're not giving them a total pass on this thing, but it still is kind of exciting. It's something different in the Apple Mac community and something that we can talk about. So I thought I'd talk about my experience in sort of getting access to the card and activating it, or not activating it, but signing up. And then I'll give you some tips and tricks. If you have an Apple card, some things that you might want to know about using your Apple card, working with the app, how to handle certain things and stuff like that. So I did get my early invite this week. It came via email. I was able to click on it. Something important to know about that email invite: you want to make sure that you get one from the email address that is tied to your Apple ID or the account you want to use on your device. So if you have it attached to an iCloud account or an Apple ID, make sure that that matches up, because if it doesn't, then it's not really going to work and you're going to have to wait for another invite. You're basically going to have to cancel your card and get another invite. I actually talked about this with David Ginsberg on his In Touch with iOS podcast this week. So if you want to go listen to our conversation about that, you can do that. But I got my invite, and just like everybody told me and many of you said in your email comments to me, the sign-up process was totally seamless, took literally 1 to 2 minutes. I didn't time it, but I don't think it took longer than 2 minutes. Just asked a few questions, had to put in a little bit of personal information, but not a lot, agreed to some terms, and then I was given the offer for the card. They gave me my interest rate, my credit limit, and said okay, and boom, they added it to my digital wallet, and it was as easy as that. What's interesting is when it initially goes into your wallet, because you don't have any transaction history and you don't have any categories of purchases, the card goes in as 100% pure white. So like all the images that I'd seen of the Apple card so far always had this multicolored kind of pattern across the card. When you first get it in your wallet, you don't get that. You just get the white because you haven't made any purchases. And then once you start to make purchases and transactions, then it'll sort of fill in those colors, because the majority of the color is the kind of majority area that you're spending in. So, you know, if it's all purple, it's all like services, and if it's orange, I forget how all the colors break down, but basically the color of the card on the front of the card shows kind of your spending trends in terms of categories and stuff like that. Another interesting thing about the sign-up process is part of it is they ask you if you want the physical card. Like, do you want to be sent the physical titanium card? And I thought, really? You have to ask this? Like, who doesn't want it? It's like so cool. Even if you never use it, I just want to have it in my wallet. Show it off to people. I don't know. I'm a nerd, right? I'm an Apple geek. So, you know, sue me. But I'm definitely getting the card. It said it's going to take about a week to get here, although I've been hearing people are getting them a little bit quicker. So I'm just going to be patiently checking the mailbox every single day, right? That's patience. I don't know. I'm looking forward to receiving that too. And I know this is super dumb, but hey, it's fun at the same time. It does look like most people will get approved. So if you're wondering what kind of credit score you need to have, what kind of credit rating you need to have, we've been hearing that they're getting approvals on credit scores as low as 620. What they're basically doing is adapting the limit. So you end up with a low limit, I think $700, $750, somewhere in that range. And you will have the highest interest rate, of course, which is 23.99%. So not a great thing. And maybe might not be right for everybody. And I think this is where it gets a little dicey with Apple getting into the credit card business, right? Is like, this can be bad. It can take advantage of people who aren't very cautious about their money or their spending and stuff like that. But I also think there's an opportunity here. So Apple is taking some flack this week for, you know, giving credit cards out to people with low credit scores, subprime lending, basically. And I think that's one way to look at it. I also think another way to look at it is that there's a lot of people that maybe need an opportunity to build better credit. Maybe we were all young at one point and maybe made some not so great financial decisions, maybe got ourselves in a place where we might have a low credit rating. And this might be a way to get some credit back, to kind of earn your way back. And Apple, with the software that they have in the wallet app, give you a lot of great opportunities to kind of, one, very easily see your spending and see how you're spending. But more importantly, they give a lot of transparency in what your credit card is costing you and what happens if you don't pay off the full amount every month and how much interest are you paying. And they make that upfront and easy to see. And that can help people, I think, build some better credit habits and some better responsibility with using credit cards. So I think there's an opportunity here, and I'm kind of choose to look at it more on the positive side of things. But of course, this is the MacCast, this is the community, so we're open to all kinds of opinions. If you have thoughts on this, let me know. But it does look, just for general information, like Apple is trying to, or probably more appropriately, Goldman Sachs is opening this credit card up to a broad range of people with a lot of different financial backgrounds. So just something to be aware of. Another thing to be aware of is, as we talked about a little bit on the last episode of the MacCast, I think you can't export your transaction data to other applications, but there actually is a way inside the app to get a PDF version of your transactions. So you can get a statement, a PDF statement. If you open up the wallet app on your iPhone and tap on your Apple card, you can tap on the total balance square and then choose the month of statement you want to get and select download PDF statement. And then you can grab that, you can view it, you can share it, you can export it, you can print it, you can do all the things that you might want to do. And you will have a physical, at least a physical record of your transactions outside of the wallet app. One of the complaints that's sort of been levied is everything's tied into that app. And if you don't have access to that app, then you don't have that information. But here's at least one way where you can work around that. I would presume at some point, too, that Apple will build a way to export this data into other financial apps like Mint or things like that. So I think that's coming in the future. They just don't have it here at launch, and I would expect to see that change. Another big feature of the card is the daily cash. That's the rewards. So you get different rewards depending upon how you're making your purchases. You get 3% back, 3% cash back on Apple purchases. So that would be like things on the Apple Store, Apple products, iCloud services, all those sorts of things. You get 2% back on your Apple Pay purchases, and you get 1% back when you use that physical titanium card anyplace else. And so a big question is how does the daily cash work? Where does it go? How often do I get it? All those sorts of things. Daily cash is actually going to get added into your Apple Cash card. If you haven't signed up for an Apple Cash card, you don't have that in your wallet, then it will just sort of accrue and build up in the background. You won't be able to see how much cash you have, but the minute that you sign up for that Apple Cash card and put that into your wallet, all of that money will flow into that, and you'll have that available to spend. And that is a separate location. So you can take that cash and you can use it at Apple Pay for an Apple Pay purchase, or you can send it to a friend or whatever you want to do. You can get it through the Apple Cash card. And as far as when it's paid, it looks like it's actually paid out as soon as your transaction is settled. So the minute that it kind of settles up with the bank, then you're going to get that card. It doesn't just happen sort of once a day, even though Apple calls it daily cash. Now, I think they do give you a notification and a summary each day of how much daily cash you earned. And then I think you also get a weekly summary or notification about your daily cash, which is interesting, a weekly notice on your daily cash. But you get the point, right? And then another thing you might be wondering about is what's to prevent someone from just going out and like making a big giant purchase, getting their Apple daily cash, and then returning that. Well, it turns out if you return a purchase that you made on your Apple Card, you get refunded the purchase price, obviously, of the product that gets put back onto your Apple Card, but also the corresponding daily cash that you received from that purchase, that is actually charged back to your card as well. So it all goes back on your Apple Card. You're not going to be able to kind of game the system and, you know, say buy a new Mac Pro, max it out and get a bunch of Apple daily cash and then just keep it for free. Obviously, they've thought that through. So that's how that's handled. Another cool thing that was not readily apparent is that you do get that 3% cash back on all of your Apple purchases. You can also get that 3% cash back on your iPhone upgrade program. So if you've opted into Apple's iPhone upgrade program and you go in and you change your automated payment method to use your Apple Card, you will get 3% cash back on those payments. And that is interesting because that program's not actually run through Apple. It's actually run through Citizens Bank, who Apple partnered with for that, but it apparently still counts for your daily cash. So one of the first things that I did when I read this was I went into my Citizens One account and changed it to use my Apple Card. Now, in case you're wondering, well, wait a minute, Adam, I have my digital card in my wallet, right? But I don't know my credit card number and I don't know my CVV2 code. You can actually get that information from the wallet app. Just go into your Apple Card and then tap on the three little dots in the top, up at the top, and then you can tap on card information. You will have to authenticate with your Face ID, but then that screen will show you your card number, your expiration date, and your security code. And at any time, you can actually request a new card number as well from that screen. So, you're not stuck with the same card number. If you have the account get compromised or something like that, you can simply request a new number and invalidate the old one. So that's how you do that. And then another thing that you might want to do, and actually I personally think you should do, is set up auto payments. So you don't miss a payment, you don't accrue any of that interest. You can attach a bank account or several bank accounts to your Apple Card and then make your payments via that account. But you can also set up automated payments. And the way you do that is you open up the wallet app, you tap on your Apple Card, you again tap on the three dots in the upper right-hand corner, tap on bank accounts, and then you can choose to edit, add, or remove a new account. And when you add an account, you're going to need your bank routing number and your account number, but you can put those in there. You can have multiple accounts set up. You can set up one as your default payment method for auto payments. And you can also, if you want to make manual payments from the app, you can use those accounts to make those payments. So that's how you'll generally make your payments on your card. The last thing to know about, and last little tip to know about related to payments, is if you lose your phone and don't have access to the wallet app, that really is the only way to make a payment online, basically. There is no website you can go to make a payment. You can't log in anywhere. It's all done through the wallet app and through your phone, at least for now. So if you lose your phone or don't have access to it and you need to make a payment, you're going to have to call Apple, get connected to Goldman Sachs, and then make a payment over the phone. That's the only other way to do it. I guess the other way you could do it is if you have access to another device that has access to your account, you could do it that way. We've been hearing that Apple is going to come out with some sort of wallet app or card management app for the iPad. We don't have that now. Right now, wallet is only available, I'm pretty sure, on the iPhone. So you're going to have to manage and do everything through there. So there you go, a bunch of Apple Card related tips. I know it feels weird that we're doing this, but it's really cool. And if you have some additional tips related to Apple Card, or you just want to make some comments or ask some questions about Apple Card, feel free to send those to me, maccast@gmail.com. Last thing I have for you this week is a question that I received via email from Calvin. And he asked me something that I thought was a pretty simple question, but then when I went to try and figure out an answer for him, I realized this is a little bit more complex than it probably should be. But I think we have a couple answers for you, Calvin, so I'll do my best. Calvin said, "Hey, do you know a way for me and my brother to each have a hard drive with each other's stuff on it at our homes in case of a fire?" So basically doing a remote backup, but instead of going to the cloud and using a cloud backup service like Backblaze, Calvin would have a hard drive somehow connected at his brother's house, and his brother would have one at Calvin's house, and then Calvin would back up his Mac to the drive at his brother's house, and vice versa, right? We do this kind of remote over the internet backup, but to a personal hard drive in another location. And there used to be, Calvin, a way to do that with CrashPlan. The CrashPlan home software would allow you to exactly do that. So you could install the software on your Mac, on your brother's Mac. He could have a hard drive connected to that Mac, and then through the CrashPlan software, you could back up directly to that. And you could do all of that without even having a CrashPlan account. You didn't have to pay CrashPlan anything. It was just part of their free software. And I always thought that was a really cool feature, and I know a few people that took advantage of that. Of course, CrashPlan canceled their home program, so I don't think that's an option anymore. So the best option that I could think of that kind of simulates a similar thing is ChronoSync plus ChronoAgent. So Econ Technologies makes ChronoSync, and I've talked about ChronoSync on the MacCast in the past because I actually use it locally over my network. I actually use this combination, ChronoSync plus ChronoAgent, to back up to my Mac Mini, which has a Drobo connected to it. So on a schedule, I have a bunch of different schedules for different folders and volumes and stuff like that. ChronoSync kicks in the background and it backs up, say, my entire podcast directory where I save all my source files for the MacCast over to that Drobo, which is in another room in my house. And it does that all through ChronoSync. Well, ChronoSync can also do that same thing through the internet. And ChronoAgent is just a little extra utility that adds some additional functionality, reliability, better performance for doing backups over a network versus kind of the built-in networking that you have in your Mac. So it works locally. It also works across the web. You can enable SSL encryption, so you can encrypt the connection, the data over the connection as you're going point to point, and you can get everything backed up that way. And I think ChronoSync is a great application. I love it for syncing and backup. You can even create bootable backups over that ChronoSync connection. So, and it's a pretty good price. You can get the bundle, ChronoSync plus ChronoAgent, for $60. Now, you would need a copy of those two things, and your brother would need a copy of those two things to go both ways. But overall, I think that's a pretty good investment. $120, one-time investment, and you've got your own personal cloud backup. So that's a solution that I would look into. Another option might be to set up a set of network-attached storage drives and sync over the internet that way. And off the top of my head, I can think of a few options. Western Digital has their MyCloud line, which I think has a feature called WD Sync. And that basically allows you to sync one MyCloud device to another. So I would imagine the way this would work is you would get one MyCloud drive, connect it to your Mac locally, do your backups locally to that, and then have another MyCloud drive on the network at your brother's house, and then set up the WD Sync feature to sync your local MyCloud drive to the remote MyCloud drive. Basically create a clone of it over the internet, and then you would have that offsite storage. So it would involve you having to buy a couple of drives, but they're relatively affordable, I think in the $100 to $200 range per drive, depending upon the features that you want. So that definitely would be an option. Another option is Promise has their Apollo Cloud device, and that does allow remote backup over the internet. And it also has a feature where you can do remote Time Machine backups over the internet. I can't vouch for how that works because I don't have one of these products, but I do know that it's a feature of it. And Promise, they make the Promise Raids, which are amazing professional devices. They make really good products. So I feel pretty confident in recommending Promise and their Apollo Cloud products. So you might want to look into that. And then a final option that I could think of off the top of my head was Synology. So Synology NAS drives, they have a thing called CloudStation, and there's a client called CloudStation Backup, which is basically a lot like the CrashPlan thing that I mentioned before. So if your brother had a Synology NAS installed at his house with CloudStation running on it, you could download the CloudStation Backup software, and then you could set up backups to go from your Mac to that Synology over the internet, and you could do the same thing vice versa. And Synology has a wide range of products, everything from, I think, two disk NAS drives all the way up through like eight disk NAS drives. So you can spend, you know, a little bit, or you can spend a lot. It is going to be a little more expensive than, say, the Western Digital MyCloud solution or doing the ChronoSync solution, but it is another option and something that you could look into. So those were just my thoughts off the top of my head, the things that I could come up with to solve this problem for Calvin. I know you might have some other suggestions, those of you in the community that you're using. I can think of some other creative ideas. I mean, if you want to get really technical and nerdy, you probably could do a bunch of stuff with command line scripts and rsync and figure out a way to do it that way, Calvin. I don't know if you want to go that deep. I'm assuming that most people are looking for a more Mac-like sort of plug-and-play out-of-the-box solution. So I gave you a couple of my ideas. Let's see what the community comes up with. So if you have a way you're doing this, if you have a bit of software or a bit of technology that you know about, shoot me an email, or even better, send me an audio comment. Tell me what you're using, maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great software and applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, I welcome your emails and audio comments. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And finally, if you want to follow me online between shows, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page by visiting facebook.com/TheMacCast. But that will do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.